hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor, Josh Douglas.
How much does it matter if you contact your state representative? Do we really have a representative democracy? Here to answer those questions is Representative Jamie Long, the majority leader of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Jamie is also a law school friend of mine. We both had our start in the voting rights course with Professor Spencer Overton at George Washington Law School. Jamie, it's great to see you. Welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Good to see you, Josh. Thanks so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about the importance of hearing from constituents. What actually happens when a voter contacts your office, whether by phone, email, or otherwise?
Well, it matters a lot, and particularly at the state level, where we are a lot closer to the ground to what we're hearing from our constituents. So I represent in Minnesota just 40,000 people, and states are different sizes. There are some that are almost as big as congressional districts if you go out to California. But in a lot of states, it means that it doesn't take a whole lot to get noticed from your constituents. And I think if I get four or five emails or calls on a topic, I know that it's something I got to pay attention to and take care of.
And so what do you actually do when you get a phone call or an email from a constituent on some topic of public interest?
Well, if it's personal, I respond to it in person. You know, I have a staff that helps me sort through some of the form emails and voicemails that we get in the office. But I try very hard to answer every single call and email. If somebody took the time to write to me, I try to take the time to write back to them. So it's time intensive, but I think it's worth it. And I'll tell you that on democracy in particular, I've seen a huge uptick in interest in the last couple of years. I ran on democracy issues when I first was seeking office now 6 years ago. And it was something I talked about at the doors, and people responded well, and they said it was something that they cared about. But it was sort of one issue that they cared about out of many. And now it's really risen up in people's priorities, and it tends to be a top four or five issue from constituents.
That's really interesting. So you chair the Rules and Legislative Administration Committee. What is that? Tell us kind of how the sausage is made.
Sure. Well, so I'm the majority leader in the House, so I manage every debate that we have on the floor and try to help keep our team together. And I also chair the Rules Committee, so I control the bills that come to the floor. So if there's something that's getting scheduled for a vote, then that has to go through my committee. So we also deal with constitutional amendments. And so there's been some conversation in Minnesota about doing some democracy-related constitutional amendments. So I've been active in some of those discussions as well.
So it sounds like that means you have the power essentially to kill bills, to not let them go to the floor if you don't support them. How does that work? And, you know, is that part of democracy, if, you know, one committee gets to decide, you know, we're not going to let people have their vote on this, or the representatives have their vote on this?
Well, I'm elected by my peers, so I'm only majority leader because the my peers in the majority party, the Democrats, elected me to be here, and I'm part of our leadership team with Speaker Melissa Hortman. So we work really closely together on trying to make sure that we have the support of our caucus, our full team, when we're bringing bills to the floor. So I don't freelance very often. I certainly could, as part of the power of the role. But if I did that too much, I think my caucus would probably rein me back in pretty quick.
But let's talk about the opposition party, right? Let's say the Republicans have a bill they want to support, but they don't control the Rules Committee, right? Do they feel like, well, you know, we're not even getting our chance to have our say on the floor and get a vote on this particular issue?
Well, if they don't have support of enough Democrats, it probably won't get to my committee anyway, because it'll get killed at an earlier committee stop. So I'm sort of the last stop on the train station before you get your final floor vote. We have worked on getting bipartisan bills to the floor. We actually have a process that we've set up for non-controversial bills as a way to try to get things calendared that we know aren't going to take that much time and won't need amendment on the floor. So we do try to facilitate those types of processes when there's agreement.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about democracy issues, as you mentioned. You've long advocated during your time in the House for expanded ballot access. Yeah, I like to think maybe that stems from our voting rights class we took together.
Absolutely.
In law school. But talk a little bit more about why ballot access and voter access is important to you and what sorts of things you've done to support that in Minnesota.
Well, Minnesota has a really proud civic culture and tradition of being a high voting turnout state. We've usually been number one in voter turnout. We get real sad when we're anything less. We have sometimes been two or three, depending on the election cycle. But it is a point of civic pride that we participate. That said, it still only means we're usually in the mid to high 70s in a good year in terms of our voting rates. And so there's still up to a quarter of the voting age population who's not voting for various reasons. And that tends to also be disproportionately young people, disproportionately people of color in the state. So we're trying hard to expand access to voting and make sure that there aren't artificial barriers put up in the state. So it's been a high priority of mine since I was first elected. And I've pushed for a number of different policy options myself. One that I tried really hard to get through, and we finally did last year, is allowing folks to opt in to being a permanent absentee voter. And this works really well for individuals who have tough work schedules or have trouble getting to a polling place on an election day. And we had an absentee system, but you had to re-up it every year. So you'd get a form in the mail and you had to say, yes, this year again, I would like to be an absentee voter. So we finally are setting up a system where that can be a permanent checkbox that folks can designate for themselves, which I'm really excited about.
And it's worth pointing out that that sort of permanent absentee system is occurring in so-called red states like Arizona, like so-called blue states now with Minnesota. But let's talk a little bit more about, you know, your discussion of wanting to expand access to certain constituencies, young people, people of color. You're a pretty blue state. You have a pretty blue state. Minnesota has been reliably Democratic. So what do you say to the, you know, potential criticism that, you know, just trying to increase the voters for your side and entrench yourself in the majority?
Yeah. Well, I'd point to Restore the Vote as a good example of a policy that we support, even though I really have no idea how that'll turn out from a partisan standpoint. So just this past year, we passed a law that now allows folks who are formerly incarcerated but not yet off of probation to vote. And that's a significant population in Minnesota. And so we, I think there's about 55,000 Minnesotans who in the state are on probation or parole, but not incarcerated anymore. And these folks are all over the state. We know that they are in every single community, rural communities, urban communities. And we heard, I think, bipartisan support for the bill when it came through and folks testifying from different backgrounds. But for us, this was just the right thing to do. We felt like individuals who were returning to society should have their rights restored. We know that is anti-recidivism to have people feel like they're included in society, feel like they're we want them to be a part of society again. It's very pro-social to vote. So I think that, you know, even if the numbers had someone had come to me and said, hey, I think this is going to give a 5 to 10% Republican advantage, I'd say fine, it's the right thing to do. I mean, I think that we know that democracy should be fair, should be open, should be accessible to voters. And that, I think, are the principles that we are standing on in the state.
So you've said publicly that some of the issues that you want to focus on in the legislature are things like affordable housing and childcare and climate change. Those sound really important. You also mentioned democracy, you know, is in the top four or five that people mentioned to you. But how do we convince people that democracy should be number one? In my view, of course, I do a whole show called Democracy Optimist, and I focused my career and scholarship on voting rights issues. Obviously, you know, affordable housing, childcare, climate change affect people every day. But doesn't democracy, and how do we convince people that it should be even a higher priority?
Well, I always like to tell people, no matter what your number one issue is, democracy should be your number two issue. So I hear you on number one, but
fair enough.
But that to me is because without access to the ballot, without folks being able to raise their voices and express their points of view, we know that that's going to affect the quality of leadership of who is elected. And it's also going to affect the issues that people want to focus on. There's good data and polling that shows that the opinions of regular voters don't always match the opinions of people who don't show up. And if you think about young people just as a particular demographic, if we have much, much lower participation from folks in the 18 to 25 range as opposed to the 65 to 70 range, you're going to disproportionately have those points of view represented and the policies that are being pushed at the Capitol. So it really is a core principle of our democracy to expand the franchise and make sure we have access to everybody. And it, I think, results in better policy outcomes because we're actually going to be speaking on behalf of the full community.
Which goes back to my very first question about, you know, constituent services and what happens when a constituent contacts you. So if you had a magic wand to implement just one voting rule for Minnesota, what would it be?
Well, boy, we waved a lot of magic wands last year. So maybe I'll mention a few of the things we got done. So I already talked about permanent absentee voting. I talked about restoring the right to vote. We also did automatic voter registration, which is something that we'd been pushing hard for. We expanded and made permanent the number of days for early voting that we wanted to do. But I guess what I would say is one of the things that I view as kind of unfinished business from what we didn't do last year is campaign finance reform. And so if I had a wand to wave, I would try to move us to a system where we had ideally a pure campaign finance system. I think that's a pure publicly funded system. We really haven't seen a state get quite there yet. We've seen states do matching programs, which I think are really important. I carried a bill to try to move us to the Seattle democracy voucher model, where you would have folks get access to a voucher that they could give to a candidate.
And that, let's just pause real quick to make sure listeners know what that means, because it's super interesting and innovative. So in Seattle, every voter receives four $25 vouchers that they hand out to candidates who have agreed to accept public financing with the restrictions that go along with it, kind of an anti-corruption. So candidates are campaigning not just for votes, but for what they call democracy dollars. You think that would work in the statewide level in Minnesota?
I think so. We have a program in Minnesota called the Public Campaign Refund. And so it's more of an opt-in than an opt-out. And I think that's a big distinction, which is why I was pushing for us to do the Seattle approach. But right now, the first $75 that you give to a candidate or to a campaign committee or a party committee is refundable. And so you get a receipt, you can send that in, the state processes it quickly and gets it back to you. But we have pretty low participation rate because you have to know that the program exists. You have to be willing to front the $75 or able to front the $75 to give to a candidate. So, you know, less than 1% of Minnesotans actually participate in this, even though it's a program that every single Minnesotan could if they chose. So I think moving to a system like Seattle has would sort of build on the success that we have with the public campaign refund program and make it even more accessible to people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one thing to note about the Seattle program is the studies have shown that the number and kinds of people who contribute to a candidate because they're getting public dollars to do it has certainly increased. It's no longer just the special interests that are funding campaigns. So are you optimistic about voting in elections? There's so much doom and gloom out there, right? You seem like, you know, like me, an optimist. How do you remain optimistic?
I sure am a democracy optimist. I think that I think we've seen how much folks value and care about our elections and our democracy in the United States. And certainly we've heard that in Minnesota when we've seen democracy under threat, and with certainly the very visible January 6th protests or some of the decisions at the Supreme Court, we've seen pushback. But also in Minnesota, we had a real test. We had the GOP, when they were in charge, put photo ID, restrictive photo ID requirement on the ballot. And we became the first state in the country in Minnesota to vote that down. And I think the reason was people saw that it was a way to restrict access to the ballot. And they saw that it was designed not to simplify or help people vote, but to prevent people from voting. And so Minnesotans rejected that. We want to be a state that values our democracy, that keeps an open democracy. And so I think that does give me hope.
Yeah. All right. Well, why should people vote then in general? I mean, you know, imagine a Republican in Minnesota who says, look, the Democratic candidate's going to win the presidential election in Minnesota. It's a very blue state. I'm in Kentucky. So a Democrat in Kentucky says, why do I bother? We know the Republican's going to win the state's Electoral College votes. What's your response to someone who has that view?
Well, I'd go have them talk to your governor, or I'd have them talk to some of the folks in Minnesota who've won in close races. I think Minnesota is an interesting state because we are pretty purple still. And we've had seats in the legislature that were decided this last cycle by as few as 15 votes. One that was 33 votes, another that it was 100 votes. So it's pretty easy when you're in a district like that to make the case. But I think even when you're in a district like mine, which is overwhelmingly one party, I think that your vote is your voice, right? It's a little cliche, but I think it is true that people need to feel some agency in their government and their politics. And at least as a politician, when someone comes up and says, hey, I voted for you and I want you to listen to me, right? It matters, right? I'll perk up a bit when somebody says that they showed up and they participated. And so I think it gives you a seat at the table to be able to weigh in and make sure that your voice and your views are taken into account when we're passing laws up here at the Capitol.
Yeah, and of course, you never know, when that one vote might make the difference in some of those local elections or state representative elections, even if you think that your state is going to go to the other party on the presidential side. Jamie Long is the majority leader of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Super enlightening conversation about the value of contacting your local representative. So I hope you take his message to heart. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Josh, a lot of innovation going on in Minnesota. In light of that, give us an election law highlight.
Yeah, Jamie mentioned some of the laws that the state passed in 2023. I want to talk about a few more because they really sought to ease access to the ballot and secure the voting system. And I like pointing out laws or combination of laws that are both voter access and integrity measures. I think these two things really need to go hand in hand. First, the state is trying to help citizens who do not speak English. Of course, they're entitled to vote after all. In districts where at least 3% of the population speaks English, quote, less than very well, the state must provide translated ballots at polling locations. And certain districts may also be required to have an interpreter present if a registered voter requests one. Those requirements go beyond the ones that the Federal Voting Rights Act already imposes for jurisdictions with a significant population of language minorities. Second, Minnesota passed a law to protect voters from intimidation and interference. The law creates criminal and civil penalties for interfering with voters and those who may assist voters. Threatening someone with harm if they vote, deceiving someone about when and where they can vote as a way of preventing them from voting, and physically hindering someone from conducting a voter registration drive are all explicitly prohibited. Now, of course, we'd hope we wouldn't have the need for those kinds of laws to protect voters. Unfortunately, in this political climate, we do need those protections, and it's good to see Minnesota taking those issues seriously.
Well, give us a fun election fact.
This is another one that I'm asked a lot. Why is Election Day on a Tuesday in November? Well, I think we can thank the farmers. Minnesota is the sixth largest farming state and the fourth coldest state in the nation. Well, how does that relate to elections? An official election day hasn't always been around, but it's the farming community that kind of changed things. In the 1800s, the election day was dependent on farmers and the weather. Farmers were not able to travel easily until after harvest, and winter conditions could make traveling to vote a problem. So elections tended to happen in the late fall. In 1845, Congress officially set a uniform election day, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, still pretty tailored to farmers. The rationale was that citizens could observe the Saturday or the Sabbath for religious voters, travel to vote on Monday, vote on Tuesday, and return home for Wednesday, which was often market day.
And in addition to traveling to vote, what's that one thing that we can do to support democracy?
Representative Long said it. Contact your representatives, particularly your state representatives. They actually want to hear from you. Of course, that first means you got to figure out who your state representative, state senator, member of Congress, local representatives are, your city council members. Unfortunately, many Americans don't know the names of the people who represent them. So first, go figure out who it is, who your state representative is, your state senator. Then pick up the phone or send an email to each of them to introduce yourself. Tell them what issue is most important to you. Hopefully that will include democracy and voting rights. If not, number one, at least as number two.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.